kill this guy. There is a knock on the door of the interview room, and the detective excuses himself to go speak with another investigator. After he lets himself out, I look down at my shirt. The blood has started to dry, stiff, against my chest. I wonder if someone has called Concise's son. I wonder if they'd even know how to find him. The door opens again, and Rydell approaches with a face as blank as glass. "We just found a zip gun in your buddy's locker. Care to comment?" I can see it, buried under the stash of medications and food items that Concise had gotten from the canteen. The zip gun that he had been dutifully crafting to prevent a moment like this. I'd assume that it, too, had been stolen. But apparently, someone else had been making one, too. I find myself fighting for breath, for logic. It wasn't used. Rydell doesn't even blink. "There's no ballistics testing for a zip gun," the detective says. "But I bet you know that, being educated and all." I swallow hard. I'd like to speak to my attorney. I'm given a telephone with a long cord, and Rydell stands over my left shoulder while I dial Eric's cell phone. I try three times, and am told over and over by a tinny voice that the person I am trying to reach is not available. I am beginning to think that single sentence is the story of my life. I am kept alone in a cell, since the detectives can't interrogate me until I reach Eric. In spite of the isolation, however, the rumors reach me. Flacco has been bragging to the Carnales, the patch-holding New Mexican Mafia members. "The white boys," he says, "are too wimpy to pull off a stunt like this. Chicanos are the ones with the big huevos. The detectives ought to be speaking to the real man who killed that nigger." 48 hours after Concise's death. 48 hours during which I am unable to reach my attorney. The detectives take Flacco up on his offer to talk. During the interview, Flacco whips out a zip gun he's hidden beneath his testicles during the pat-down search prior to transfer to GID and presents it to Detective Rydell. There is only one inconsistency, one that anyone in B-Pod would realize, and that the detectives don't. In jail, you know exactly who has what weapon. Concise had been making a zip gun, one that has already been found on our cell, where he'd left it. Only one other zip gun existed in our pod. The one Styx had tried to use on me during the rec yard fight. The only weapon Flacco was known to have was the shank he'd made out of that toothbrush. I think of what Concise told me once, of Flacco screwing up his first assigned hit. Killing Concise would help him save face and prove he's macho enough to be a soldier in the Mexican Mafia. If Flacco knew he was headed for a long prison sentence anyway, maybe he'd rather do it with the respect of the Carnales. But how had he gotten Styx's zip gun? The next day, I'm brought back to GID to speak with Detective Rydell. "Bury him," I say, the moment he comes into the room, "and antimony compounds. Even if you can't match a bullet to a zip gun with ballistics, you can test for gunshot residue." you can also test it for blood. Since the most accurate way to use one is to press it up against the victim's head. He leans forward. I've got 2 zip guns. One of them had blood residue on the edge. Coincidentally, that same gun tested positive for the chemical compounds you get when you fire a .22 round, which happens to be what was in your Sally's brain. The other zip gun, he says, was the one we found in your cell. I fall back against the chair. I cannot find the strength to answer the detective when he tells me I am no longer a suspect. I'm relocated to general population again, this time on level 2, and placed in a cell with a man nicknamed Hazelnut, who has a habit of pulling his hair out in small tufts and weaving them with threads from the blanket into macrame. This, though, is better than the alternative. Even if Flacco's in custody, I cannot expect the blacks to protect me anymore, and my status with the whites will not have changed. I wonder how long a body can last without any sleep. How many nights it will take me to make a shank. I stop speaking, because I can't trust ordinary language anymore. Words, in spite of what you think, don't always stay fixed. Take emancipation. It might be reconfigured into a maniac night op, or an inanimate cop, or maintain, cope. Madison Street Jail becomes rationalism jested, or slanted majorities. Delia Hopkins, by another name, could be diaphone silk, akin polished, Oedipal Caniche. And Andrew Hopkins? Shake it up a bit, and you find dank ownership. Orphans winked. Kidnapper shown. Only 24 hours into my residency on level 2, I'm moved. Another inmate has requested a switch because he'd been threatened by a cellie. A white boy named Hayseed. Hayseed specifically asked the DOs if he could cell with me instead, saying we are old friends. We aren't friends. I don't even know him. My best guess is that he knows about the meth. Maybe he thinks I have some on me. I enter the cell and take his measure. Hayseed is still a kid, all yellow hair and buck teeth. I hope you don't mind, man, about the switch. That other guy, he reeked. I don't think he showered in like 3 months. And I knew you were stuck with the human hairball, so I figured you might not mind a change of scenery. Hayseed likes to talk. He segues from the merits of Kubota tractors over John Deere, to the fact that Nebraska is where spam is made, to the Brettes he stole from the girls he raped and hid in the rotten core of a ponderosa pine tree. I spend a lot of time staring at the upper bunk. Hayseed. Ash-eyed. Ye Hades. I count the number of coughs that ripple through the quiet after lights out. I do what it takes to stay awake, and think I've succeeded until the middle of the night, when I wake up to find that my nostrils and mouth are blocked. Hayseed's hand pressed tight against my flesh. I thrash out with my arms and legs. I try to reach for his wrist, but he is standing behind me and there are already stars at the corners of my vision. "Wake up, nigger lover," Hayseed whispers. "Your spook shouldn't have refused to sell to the Brotherhood. It was enough to make the boys upstairs give the green light for the hit." His palm grinds down against my jaw, my teeth. "My brother said the nigger never even saw it coming." "His brother killed Concise? What about Flacco?" "It was almost too easy, the way the Spick volunteered to hide the gun after it was done. But Flacco didn't tell no one he was gonna say he'd made the hit, just so he could get his wet patch with the Mexican Mafia. You are supposed to go down for doing the deed." Hayseed leans close. "My brother also wants me to give you something," he says. And he parts his fingers wide enough for me to gulp for air. He kisses me full on the mouth. Without missing a beat, he backhands me across the cheek, so hard that I start bleeding. "I don't know your brother," I choke out, terrified. "Guess he never did get a chance to tell you where he got his nickname," Hayseed says. "But then, a smart guy like you already knows that Nebraska's out in the sticks." When Eric arrives, the sun is just coming up. I still have cotton wadded into my broken nose, courtesy of the infirmary. One of my eyes has swelled shut. My throat is raw from the yelling I did to call the detention officers to the cell. Eric stands up when I open the door to the conference room. "I know I've been sort of unreachable for the past couple of days. I've been going through a rough..." "Holy shit, Andrew!" When he sees the condition of my face, he goes pale. "They didn't tell me." "I can't stay here," I say wildly. "You have to get me out." "Andrew, your trial starts in 2. I won't go back to that cell, Eric." He nods tightly. "All right. I won't leave here until they put you in administrative segregation." The words are balm. All I've needed to hear. I find myself sinking to my knees, bowing to the floor like a supplicant. I do not think I've ever cried in front of Eric. I don't think I've ever cried in front of anyone until 2 days ago. You make yourself strong because it's expected of you. You become confident because someone beside you is unsure. You turn into the person others need you to be. "Andrew," Eric says, and I can hear how he is embarrassed for me. But I know how much lower there is for me to sink. That's the difference between us. "I can't do this," I say. "I know. I'm going to talk to... I mean, in the long run, Eric, I can't go to prison." I meet his gaze, my eyes still damp. "If I do, they'll kill me, too." Eric clasps my hand. "I swear to you," he vows, "I'll get you acquitted." Like anyone else who finds himself adrift at sea, I reach for this lifeline. I believe him. And just like that, I remember how to float.
Fitz. If it had been easy for Romeo to get Juliet, nobody would have cared. Same goes for Cyrano and Don Quixote and Gatsby and their respective paramours. What captures the imagination is watching men throw themselves at a brick wall over and over again, and wondering if this is the time that they won't be able to get back up. For everyone who adores a happy ending, there's someone else who cannot help but rubberneck at the accident on the side of the road. You wonder, though, what would have happened if Juliet's best friend started flirting with Romeo? If Gatsby got drunk one night and told Daisy how he really felt? If any of those poor romantic fools would have driven hours north to the Hopi Reservation and doubled back, the word sucker fizzing like acid in their bellies as they sneaked glances across the car at the woman they loved, knowing she was going home to another man. You wonder if any of them would have been as stupid as I was and kissed her. Listen, I say, it was an accident. One look, and I can tell she isn't buying it. I promise it won't happen again. But Sophie narrows her eyes. Liar. I have taken her out for ice cream, mainly because the thought of staying away from Delia after yesterday was both what I wanted more than anything and equally impossible. And mostly because once I arrived on her doorstep, we were both so mortified that I grabbed the first excuse I could, Sophie, and ran. Liar, I repeat. Excuse me? You kiss her all the time, Sophie says. You hug her, too, when you come back from trips. Well, maybe. But they are the sideways pecks and careful embraces of a friend, one that keeps 3 inches of space between our bodies so that we meet at the shoulders and then grow progressively farther away. She smells good, doesn't she? Sophie asks. She smells great, I agree. It's okay to kiss people when you love them. I don't love your mother, I tell her. Not like that, anyway. You give her all your French fries, even when she won't give you back onion rings, Sophie says. And when you say her name, it sounds different. How? Sophie thinks. Like it's covered with blankets. I do not say your mother's name like it's covered in blankets. And I don't always give her my French fries. Because you're right, she doesn't share. But you still don't yell at her when she's not being fair, Sophie points out, because you don't want to hurt her feelings. She slips her hand into mine and repeats. You love her. She runs toward the playground without me. It's been so long since I was Sophie's age that I've forgotten there are building blocks of love, and that the very bottom layer is comfort. When I was little, who was I most myself with? Who could I trust with my mistakes, my dreams, my history? My parents, my nursery school teacher, Delia, Eric. These were the first people I fell for. Could it still really be that simple? Could romantic love and platonic love and parental love all be different facets of the same diamond? Brilliant? No matter which face is turned up to the sun? No, because I'm not Sophie's age. No, because I know what it is to hear a woman sigh off the cloak of this world the moment she drifts asleep. No, because I've fallen into the meadow of her body. No, because puzzling through my 6th grade math homework one day, I realized that what Delia felt for Eric was not what Delia felt for me, and that this equation was not an equal sign, but a greater than. I wonder if maybe Sophie knows me better than I know myself. I do hold the word Delia balanced lightly on my tongue, as if it is made up of butterflies. I would give her every last one of my French fries. I have kissed her, whenever the opportunity was socially acceptable. And even though it isn't fair, I haven't blamed her for not loving me. But here's where Sophie is wrong. It's not because I don't want to hurt Delia's feelings. It's because when she is bruised, I'm the one who aches. I'm dragging my proverbial feet, or at least the brake of the rental car, the whole way back to Delia's trailer. It is ridiculous to think I can avoid her forever. Maybe she'll want to pretend that kiss never happened. Maybe I can just apologize and we can go on making believe. But when I pull up, her car is missing. Sophie gets out of the back seat and hurries up the steps to the trailer. I hesitate for a moment, but before I can make a clean getaway, Eric walks outside and holds up a hand in greeting. He looks like hell. His eyes are ringed with dark circles. His clothes appear to have been slept in. "Listen, Fitz," he says. "About the other day." I stand, pole-axed. "Did Delia tell him?" He sighs. "It wasn't my place to tell Delia you were writing a newspaper story about her father's trial. By comparison, that transgression seems 1,000 light years away, and far less damning." "I'm sorry, too," I say, speaking of a different mistake. I fumble with the latch of the car door. "Do you forgive me for being a dick?" "Already have." "Then why are you running out of here faster than Jesse Helms at a gay pride parade?" "It isn't you," I admit. "Ah," Eric walks toward the car. "Then it must have something to do with the way Delia ran out of here with Greta." "Faster than Jesse Helms?" "Faster than Trent Lott at an Ebony magazine get-together," Eric grins. "What are you two fighting about?"
"You," I think.
When you think about the way the three of us have woven our lives together, Eric is the knot at the center. I'm terrified to work it free. I just might discover I've unraveled everything else. I can still see him looking down at me from the crest of the oak in his backyard, crowing because he'd made it to the top first. I can hear his voice over the matchstick strike of rain on the roof of our clubhouse, swearing that the homeless guy who lived in the culvert near the Wilder Dam turned into the devil at night. I can feel the strength of him, clapping me on the back the first time we saw each other on break from college. I can see the way his eyes shine when Delia's face is what's reflected back in them. I would never ask Delia to choose between Eric and me, because I could never choose between the two of them. "I'm just tired," I say finally. "Headache." Eric heads back to the trailer. "Come on in, I'll find you some aspirin." Sighing, I follow him into the trailer. Sophie is in the bedroom playing ventriloquist for a batch of Barbies and Kens. The small table in the kitchen is piled high with paperwork. "I don't know how I'm going to be ready in time for tomorrow morning," Eric murmurs. "Some Wexton Farms seniors are flying in today. They're character witnesses. I'm supposed to pick them up at the airport." He looks at me. "Rock, paper, scissors?" With a sigh, I nod and ball my hand into a fist. "Rock, paper, scissors, shoot," we say simultaneously, and I throw paper while Eric throws scissors. "You always throw scissors," I complain. "Then why the hell do you always throw paper?" He offers a grateful smile. "It's US Air, and it lands at 3, and you're going to need 6 wheelchairs." "You owe me," I say. "Yeah, what's my tally up to? 75 billion and 6? Give or take." I walk around the table, trailing my hand over the paperwork. Words jump out at me. Hostile witness. Assailant. Provocation. 2 definitions are scrawled in marker across a legal pad. Lie. To deceive. Lie, to be in a helpless or defenseless state. "Andrew's in pretty bad shape," Eric confides. I glance up. So's Delia. Yeah. He meets my gaze. Did she tell you why she left for the Hopi Reservation in the first place? I draw in a breath. It didn't come up. She got angry because I hadn't told her something her father told me in confidence. And the thing is, Fitz, it's just going to get worse during the trial. I'm going to have to do stuff and say things that she's not going to want to hear. She'll forgive you when it's all over, I say woodenly. If Andrew's acquitted, Eric qualifies. I've spent my whole life thinking that one of these days my luck is going to run out. That one of these days Delia is going to open her eyes and realize that I'm not the guy she thinks, but just some loser who can't get his act together. What if today's that day? I try to draw an answer out of the heart of me, but can't. I'm going to look for that aspirin, I manage, and I walk into the bathroom. I close the door behind me and sit down on the lid of the toilet. If I didn't have a headache to begin with, I'm certainly developing one now. I stand up and rummage through the medicine cabinet, which is a whole different kind of pain. Here are Delia's antiperspirant, her toothbrush, her birth control pills. Here is a layer of intimacy I haven't been granted. There are no bottles of aspirin, so I find myself kneeling down under the sink and tearing apart the cabinet beneath it. Shampoo, Sophie's rubber duck, witch hazel, pine sol, and Vaseline and suntan lotion, a soft, stacked fortress of toilet paper rolls. That's when I see the whiskey. I reach deep into the cabinet and pull out the half-empty bottle that has been wedged into the corner. I carry it out of the bathroom in the crook of my elbow. Eric sits at the table, his back to me. You find it? Yeah, I say. I did. I lean over his shoulder and set the bottle down on top of a file folder. Eric freezes. It's not what you think. I sit down across from him. No? Then what's it for? Lighting the barbecue? Stripping wallpaper? He gets up and closes the bedroom door where Sophie is playing. You have no idea what trying this case is like. And when Delia left, I just couldn't handle it anymore. I'm terrified of screwing up, Fitz. He spears the fingers of one hand through his hair. Andrew nearly got killed while I was off on my little bender, he says. Believe me, that was enough to sober me up fast. It was just a taste. Honest. And I haven't touched it since then. Just a taste. I take the bottle off the table and walk to the sink, unscrew the cap, and pour the contents down the drain. As Eric watches me, his features change. It's regret, and I know, because I've seen it every single morning on my own face. I remember how we all loved Eric when he'd downed a few, how he was always the most charming, the smoothest, the funniest. I remember, too, what it was like when he could overturn a kitchen table in 3 minutes flat, when Delia would show up on my doorstep sobbing because he'd locked himself in a room and it had been 4 days. Been there, seen it, got the t-shirt, I say to Eric, and I throw the empty bottle at him so that he catches it. Does she know? Eric shakes his head. Are you going to tell her? I would like to, more than anything, but I have become a master at not telling Delia the things I should have. Without responding, I walk out the door of the trailer and then turn around. The mesh of the screen cuts Eric into a mosaic, a piecemeal Humpty Dumpty who cannot remember who he was before the fall. You're right, I say. You don't deserve her. As I drive, I pick up my cell phone. I'm going to call Delia. I'm going to get this over with once and for all. I punch in her cell number and get a recording, stating that my number is not recognized by the cellular service. I wait a few moments, thinking maybe I need to get to a part of the city covered by another set of towers. But 5 miles later, and then 10, I receive the same message. I pull onto the side of the road and call the customer service hotline for the cellular company. "Fitzwilliam McMurray," the rep says, as she looks up my number. "That's me. What's the problem?" "According to my records, your service was turned off 2 days ago." "Oh, but there's a note in your records. It's a message from a Marge Garrigy, my editor." "And?" The rep hesitates. "It says that next time, you should remember that your cell phone bills go directly to the company, and that you're fired." There is a beat on the line. "Is there anything else I can help you with?" "Thanks," I say. "I think that's plenty."
This ends Disc 11, Vanishing Acts, Disc 12.
Shortly after midnight, there's a knock on the door of my motel room. With the way my day has been going, I fully expect it to be the manager, telling me that my credit card has been revoked too. But when I open it, Delia is standing on the other side. "Buy me a drink," she says, and my heart leaps. I stare at her for a moment, and then dig into the front pocket of my jeans and hand her 3/4. "The soda machine's at the end of the hall. I was hoping for something with proof." She tilts her head. "How come it's called that anyway?"
"Because moonshine used to be used for barter. If you could mix equal parts of the liquid with gunpowder and light it on fire, there was evidence it was at least 50% alcohol." Her mouth drops open. "Why do you know that?"
"I wrote a story about it once." This would be the perfect opportunity for me to mention that Eric might be a more willing drinking buddy, that in fact he might have a bottle hidden right under their bed she could borrow. But instead, I say, "You don't like to drink."
"I know. But it works for everyone else when they want to escape."
I lean against the door jamb. "What are you escaping from?"
"I can't sleep," she admits. "I'm too worried about tomorrow."
"What about Eric?"
"He can sleep."
She pushes her way into my room and sits down in the middle of the bed, whose covers haven't been disturbed. The conversation comes so easily, I begin to wonder if I am the only one who was present during that devastating, magnificent kiss last night. Then, I realize that Delia has come to give me a way out. Maybe, if we both pretend it never happened, it'll be true. There are plenty of people. Rape victims and Holocaust survivors, widows and, God, kidnapping victims, whose worlds crack and splinter, who still manage to look back at the level horizon of their lives without seeing the break. But there's another part of me that knows, no matter how Delia and I go forward from this point, it won't be the same. Because when she smiles, I will look away before it is contagious. When we sit beside each other, I will make sure that our shoulders do not brush. When we speak, there will be spaces between our words just the shape and size of that damn kiss. I step away from her. One giant, mother may I step toward the plastic expanse of the motel desk. It is covered with stacks of paper, a Bic pen that has exploded like the Red Sea, a chain of gum wrappers. Tonight's dinner, a half-eaten ringding. "Actually, I'm busy," I say. "I was working."
"Oh," she says, deflated. "Your Gazette piece?"
"The Gazette fired me." She turns. You said you were writing a piece on my father's trial.
No, I correct. I said I was supposed to.
Delia crawls off the bed and walks toward the desk. She lets her fingers trail over the pages I have written all these weeks when I could not write anything else. Pages that amassed in such quantity, I never realized what I was producing.
Then what's this?
I take a deep breath. The story of you. She picks up the manuscript.
I was 6 years old the first time I disappeared,
she reads, the words coming alive for the first time.
Is that me talking?
I nod.
That's the way I heard you, in my head.
Delia leafs through the first few pages and then pushes it into my arms.
Read it to me, she demands.
So I clear my throat. I was 6 years old the first time I disappeared, I repeat. My father was working on a magic act. I read as Delia, as Eric, and Andrew, as myself. I read for hours. I read until my voice goes raw. I read until Delia falls asleep and I wake up in one of her dreams. I read until she takes over. And just as the sky starts blushing, she runs out of words.
Why didn't you tell me?
She whispers. You had someone else.
The person you fall for when you're 12 might not be the same one you fall for when you're 32.
Then again, I say, sometimes it is. We are curled in concentric circles, the polyester cover of the queen bed pooled around us. It reminds me of the divot a whale leaves on the smooth surface of the water after it breaches. A footprint, that's what it's called, because everyone is different. Delia would say it's just another piece of useless information I'm storing. Maybe. But I also know that she reads the last page of a book before she decides to read the first. I know that she likes the smell of new crayons, that she can whistle through her fingers and detests curry and has never had a cavity. Life is not a plot. It's in the details. I reach out to touch Delia's face. We're not going to talk about what happened yesterday, are we? I ask softly. She shakes her head. We're not going to talk about this, either, she says, and she leans forward by degrees, giving me the chance to back away before the kiss settles. When we break apart, I feel like I'm on a window ledge, dizzy and certain that every move I make will be the wrong one. I can't find a single word that won't feel like glass in my mouth. You have to go, I tell her. Just before Delia reaches the door, she turns. In her arms, she still clutches the last batch of pages I've written. I want to know how it ends, she says.
Part 8. From Institutionis Oratoriae by Quintilian. A liar should have a good memory. Delia. I remember walking the gray halls of Wexton High. Eric and I pretzeled with our hands in each other's back jean pockets. Fitz spouting off beside us about everything from what words had been admitted to the Webster's Dictionary to why even a blue lobster, if you boil it, turns red. I would nod at all the right places, but I didn't really listen to Fitz. I was more concerned with the notes Eric would slide through the breathing holes of my locker and what it felt like when his fingers slipped underneath the hem of my T-shirt to ride on the knots of my spine. and yet it turns out that I actually remember most of what Fitz said. I was paying attention even when I told myself I wasn't. If his voice hasn't been the melody of my life, it's been the bass line. So subtle, you don't notice it until it's missing. I park in front of the trailer and let myself inside quietly. It is barely 6 in the morning. Eric and Sophie will still be asleep. I reach into the cabinet above the sink and take out the coffee grounds, start a fresh pot, and suddenly feel hands on my shoulders and a kiss on my cheek. A kiss.
"You're up early," Eric says.
He is dressed to the nines in a dark gray suit and a crimson tie, so striking with his dark hair and light eyes that it takes my breath away. "I was having trouble sleeping," I say. "I went out." Is it lying if I do not tell him I've been gone the whole night and he doesn't ask? He sits down at the table and I bring him some orange juice. But instead of taking a sip of it, he traces the yawning mouth of the glass.
"Delia," he says, "I'm going to do the best I can today."
"I know that.
But I also wanted to say, I'm sorry."
My mind swirls with sentences I read last night in Fitz's writing. For what? Eric looks at me with so much unsaid that I expect the moment to crystallize, fall to the table like a marble. But he lifts his glass, breaking the spell.
"Just in case," he says.
Eric understands that the world is rarely the way it is supposed to be, and he knows that, given the chance, we don't have to wait for someone to make messes of our lives. We do a good enough job ourselves. Sophie thumps down the hallway, dragging one of her stuffed animals by its arm. "You woke me up," she accuses. But she crawls into Eric's lap, trusting one of the very people she's just blamed. She rubs her nose with the sleeve of her nightgown and leans against his lapel, still half asleep. "We make messes of our lives, but every now and then, we manage to do something that's exactly right. The challenge is figuring out which is which." There is a playroom staffed by volunteers at the courthouse, a place where Sophie can crawl through tunnels and twist pipe cleaners, while upstairs her grandfather stands trial for kidnapping. I drop her off with a promise to come back soon and then head into the courtroom to take my seat. I am waylaid by reporters who corner me with their microphones. "Have you reconciled with your mother, Delia? Have you maintained contact with your father?" I shove past the hooks and claws of their questions and duck into the courtroom. Eric is already at the defense table, organizing files with Chris Hamilton, his second chair. There are more reporters queuing in the rear, artists with sketch pads, and leaning against the far wall is Fitz, his eyes locked on me. A side door opens, and two bailiffs escort my father inside. He is wearing a suit again, but his face is pillowed and bruised, as if he has recently been in a fight. He is freshly shaved. I used to love to watch my father shave. I had no mother to show me the wonders of blush and mascara. To me, the mystery was watching the cream rise like a meringue in my father's palm, and then using it to paint the curve of his jaw. I'd make him put it on my cheeks, too. I'd pretend to shave beside him with a toothbrush. Then we would lean into the mirror together, my father checking for spots he had missed, and me glancing from his eyes and jaw and lips to mine, trying to find all the matches. As a child, all I ever wanted was to grow up to be just like him. It's really hard to hate a pregnant woman. Emma Wasserstein stands up and walks heavily toward the jury box, bellying up to the polished railing. Imagine that you are 4 years old, ladies and gentlemen, living in Scottsdale with your mother. You have a pink bedspread and a swing set in your backyard, and you go to nursery school. You see your father on weekends like you have ever since your parents divorced, and you are happy. But then one day your father tells you you aren't Bethany anymore. You don't understand this. Not any more than you've understood the fast flight from town, the motels, the new clothes, the dyed hair. When he introduces you to strangers, he calls you Delia. You say you want to go back home, and he tells you you can't. He says that your mother is dead. She begins to walk back to the prosecutor's table. Because he's your father, because you love him and trust him, you believe him. You believe your mother really is gone. You believe you aren't Bethany anymore. You believe you never have been. You move to New Hampshire and watch your father, now calling himself Andrew Hopkins, being hailed as a model citizen. You live the story he creates for you, and you forget, for 28 years, that you were ever once a victim. She faces the jury again. But there was a second victim here who never forgot. Elise Matthews woke up every morning wondering if this was the day her baby would be returned to her. Elise Matthews spent a quarter of a century not knowing if Bethany was still alive, not knowing where she might be, not even knowing what she might look like anymore. Emma folds her hands around her prodigious belly. The relationship between an adult and a child is not an equal one. We are bigger and stronger and wiser, and because of that, we enter into an unwritten contract that grants us the responsibility to put a child's interests before our own. Charles Matthews, ladies and gentlemen, violated that contract. He took a little girl with no regard for her emotional well-being and forced her into an unfamiliar, frightening life 3,000 miles away from her real home. He'll try to tell you he was being a hero. He'll try to get you to buy his lies, too, but here is the truth, ladies and gentlemen. Charles Matthews decided he was not happy with the custody arrangement worked out between himself and his ex-wife, Elise, and so he took what he wanted and ran. She turns to the jury again. 2,000 children vanish every single day in this country. The most recent report of the National Incident Studies of Missing, Abducted, Runaway, and Thrownaway Children report found that 797,500 children went missing in 1999. Of those, only 58,200 were non-family abductions, which means that every day in the United States, thousands of parents kidnap their own children, just like Charles Matthews did, because they can. But sooner or later, if we're lucky, we catch up to them. Turning, Emma points to my father. For 28 years, that man got away with breaking a mother's heart. For 28 years, he got away with breaking his daughter's trust. For 28 years, he got away with breaking the law. Don't let him get away with it for another minute. Eric stands. What Ms. Wasserstein hasn't told you, ladies and gentlemen, he says, is that Elise Matthews was damaged long before that broken heart. An alcoholic, lying in her own vomit, unconscious. That was the mother Bethany Matthews inherited. That was the woman entrusted to care for her, the woman who was too drunk to even realize that her daughter was there.
Did Andrew Hopkins take his daughter? Absolutely. But it wasn't an act of vengeance. It was an act of mercy. Walking around behind my father, Eric puts his hand on one shoulder. Mrs. Wasserstein would like you to believe that this man plotted and planned, intending to ruin his daughter's life during a routine custody visit, but that's not the case. The truth is, Andrew did bring his child home that day, and he found the television blaring, the house wrecked, and Elise Matthews passed out and reeking of alcohol. Maybe at that moment, Andrew Hopkins remembered the image of his daughter lying still in an ICU bed just months before, after her mother's neglect led to a near-fatal scorpion sting. Maybe he even tried to keep his child from having to witness her mother in that state. Only one thing is certain. He knew, unequivocally, that he couldn't bring his child back to that. Not then, and not for another second. Why didn't he go to the authorities then? Because, ladies and gentlemen, the courts were biased against Andrew already for reasons you'll learn. Because in our legal system in the late 70s, custody almost always went to the mother following a divorce, even a mother who wasn't capable even of caring for herself, much less a child. Eric heads back to his seat, hesitating midway. You all know what you would have wanted to do if you'd come home to find your ex-spouse too drunk again to safely care for your child. Andrew Hopkins is guilty of one thing, ladies and gentlemen, loving his daughter enough to keep her safe. He faces the jury. Can you honestly blame him for that? My mother is wearing a conservative blouse and skirt, but her hair is wild around her face, and her hands are covered with turquoise and garnet rings. She looks nervously over the head of the prosecutor to where Victor sits, encouraging her with a smile. The judge, a heavy man shaped like a wedding cake, signals Emma Wasserstein to begin. Can you state your name for the record? Elise, my mother says. She clears her throat. Elise Vasquez. Thank you, Miss Vasquez. Are you remarried? Yes, to Victor Vasquez. Emma nods. Would you please tell the jury where you live? Scottsdale, Arizona. How long have you lived there? Emma asks. Since I was 2. And how old are you now, Mrs. Vasquez? I'm 47. How many children do you have? 1. What's her name? My mother's eyes find mine. It used to be Bethany, she says. Now it's Delia. Did you know Bethany when she became Delia? No, I didn't, my mother murmurs. Because her father stole her from me. This wakes up the jury, interest passing through them like lightning. Can you explain what you mean by that? Emma asks. We were divorced, and we had joint custody of Bethany. Charles, that used to be his name, was supposed to bring her back on a Sunday after spending the weekend with her. He never did. Do you see your ex-husband in the room today? My mother nods and points at my father. That's him. Let the record reflect that Mrs. Vasquez has identified the defendant, Emma says. What did you do when he never returned with your child? I called and left messages at his apartment, but there was no answer and he didn't call me back. I gave him the benefit of the doubt. I thought maybe the car had broken down or he'd taken her somewhere for the weekend and they'd gotten hung up, you know. I waited until the next day, and when no one contacted me, I drove to his apartment. I convinced the superintendent to unlock the door, and that's when I realized something was wrong. What do you mean by that? All his clothes were gone. Not just enough for an overnight, but the entire closet. And the things that were important to him, like his research books and a photo of his parents before they died, and this baseball he'd caught at a Dodgers game as a kid. They were all missing, too. She looks at Emma. So I called the police. What did they do? Set up roadblocks and went to the Mexican border and put Bethany's picture on the news. They asked me to give a press conference to get public support. There were hotlines set up and posters and flyers. Did you get any responses? Hundreds, my mother says. But none of them led to my baby. Emma Wasserstein turns toward my mother again. Mrs. Vasquez, when was the last time you saw your daughter prior to her kidnapping? The morning of June 18. Charlie was supposed to bring her back on June 19, Father's Day. And how long did you have to wait to see your daughter again? My mother's eyes find mine unerringly fast. 28 years, she says. How did you feel during that time? I was devastated. There was a part of me that never gave up hope that she'd come back. My mother hesitates. But there was a part of me that wondered if I was being punished. Punished? Why? Her voice becomes a broken road. Beautiful little girls should have mothers who don't forget to send them to school with a toilet paper roll for craft day, or who know all the hand signs for Itsy Bitsy Spider. Beautiful little girls should have mothers who are waiting with a Band-Aid even before they fall off the tricycle. But instead, Bethany got me. She takes a ragged breath. I was young and I would forget things and get angry at myself. So I'd have a drink or two to feel less guilty. But that drink turned into 6 or 7 or a whole bottle. And then I'd miss the Christmas concert or fall asleep when I was supposed to be making dinner. And I'd feel so awful about it that I'd have to have another drink just to forget how I'd screwed up again. You drank when your daughter was present in the house? My mother nods. I drank when I was upset. I drank when I wasn't upset to keep myself from getting that way. I drank because I thought it was the one thing I had control of. I didn't, of course. But when you pass out, distinctions like that stop mattering. Did your drinking affect your relationship with your daughter? I'd like to think that she knew how much I loved her. In all the memories I've got of her, she's happy. Mrs. Vasquez, are you an alcoholic? Yes. My mother looks up at the jury. I always will be, but I've been sober for 25 years now. Sometimes Eric's mother would go away for weeks. He told us that she was visiting her sister. Years later, I learned she didn't have one. Once when we were kids, he admitted to me that it was easier when she was gone. I thought he was crazy. As someone who believed her mother was dead, I would gladly have taken one with faults over none at all. And just like that, I remember that before I left my mother, she left me.
There is a commotion in the aisle of the gallery, and I realize that Fitz is standing at the edge of my row, heatedly whispering with the man beside me in an effort to have him give up his seat. Fitz pulls a $20 bill from his wallet, and the man gets up so that Fitz can slide into place beside me. "Stop thinking," he commands, and he squeezes my hand. Eric gets up for the cross-examination and approaches my mother. I wonder what he sees when he looks at her. Me, maybe, or his own mother. "Mrs. Vasquez," he says, "you said that in all the memories you have of Delia, she's happy." He is calling me Delia, I realize, to remind everyone of who I really am. "Yes. But you don't have a lot of those memories, do you?" "Not enough," my mother says. "I didn't get to watch her grow up." "You didn't seem to watch her much when she was a baby, either," Eric counters. "Isn't it true that in 1972 you received a felony conviction for driving under the influence of alcohol?" "Objection, Your Honor," Emma calls out. She and Eric approach the bench, talking in whispers that are picked up by the judge's